All right, welcome, welcome, welcome back to our second episode of PCWB, a professor and a comedian walk into a bar. I'm your co-host, Sapere Vakil, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Knight.
Hey, you know what it is, people. Time flies, man. It feels like yesterday or even earlier today we filmed our last episode and we're back. but we're back with another episode of Professor and Comedian Walk Into a Bar with another stellar group of not only another comedian but another professor. And we're going to jump right into it.
We're going to jump right in to our new listeners and guests out there. Thank you for tuning in. If this is your first time, this is a new podcast supported by students at Northwestern University and an amazing crew.
Shout out
Northwestern. And what are we doing here? We're doing comedy and we're doing academia. We're mixing the two because we feel like there's a need, especially in this political moment in 2024 with everything going on, to bring some levity and some laughter and some just good creative energy, but into big societal topics, right? And so in the first episode, we talked about critical race theory, DEI, the role of the comedian versus the professor in these dark and crazy times. And today, we are going to be turning our attention to campus activism, kind of relevant these days, especially here at Northwestern. So I'm going to introduce our first guest. This is Dr. Catherine Cho from Loyola University. She is a professor of higher education. She is also a UCLA alum, so we have that in common, where she got her PhDs in, I believe, sociocultural studies and education. She's a postdoctoral fellow from the National Academy of Sciences and many other accolades. She's also kind of the perfect guest for this podcast. I'm seeing you say no. I think I'm getting some of the intro wrong, so I apologize, but I'm doing my best. But she's truly a perfect guest for this podcast because not only is she an academic, an intellectual, a researcher, but she's also an artist. And she does improv, she does comedy, she brings in art into her research and scholarship. So we're really, really pleased and grateful to welcome her to the second episode of the podcast.
Dope. And then our other guest that we have is Sonal Agarwal, one of my very close comedy friends. Help me out with the last name one time.
Sonal Agarwal.
And every time I've introduced you on stage, I don't know how many times, and I'm so confident in saying it wrong at this point that I'm gonna take classes. Yeah, but she is a mainstay on every stage possible in the city. Just featured on Daytime Chicago as well. Tremendous storyteller. One of my close friends in the Chicago comedy, and also as a point of view, very smart, and I love talking to her. Had her on my show in the past as well, and her point of view was very fascinating. I'm looking forward to our conversation collectively. So yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so let's jump in. I mean, I feel like the place to start is is actually the topic that we weren't necessarily planning on tackling in this podcast until like the 16th episode. But since we have the expertise here in-house today, and since we are at Northwestern and everything is going on with the president of this university and the campus protests, let's start there, right? So how can we, what should we be thinking right now? How do we make sense out of this moment? I'm gonna give the first question to you, Dr. Cho. How do we make sense out of this moment in higher education with all the protests going on college campuses across the country?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think part of this that I think a lot about is that like campus protests aren't new, right? Like students have constantly been protesting, and in some ways like universities and college campuses are meant for students to protest because we train and teach and create learning environments for students to imagine a better world, which in part requires them to protest to change the context and conditions of a better world. But I think what makes this area, this aspect and this moment really different is like the elephant in the room, which is that we're not really talking about Islamophobia, and we're not really talking about, you know, as we have conversations about racism, as we had protests about genderism and different sort of waves of protests from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that like, you know, there's a type of stamping down on Palestinian protests that have existed long before this, in the, like, the 1970s, 80s too, that is still regurgitating right now, that is sort of unnamed and then gets masked as we talk about, like, oh, well, we need to protect students, but it's like, which students are being protected and who is actually being protected? Because the narrative of, if I mess up, what do I do?
You just keep on going. Keep on That's going. How life works.
I don't remember. I can't see me
if I do this, right?
Look.
I actually forgot what the question was.
So let me redo the intro. Names are really important. I know, you know, as someone whose name has been butchered and messed up since I was a little kid, like, I want to make sure we give the full respect and attention to the name. So we are very pleased here today to welcome Dr. Catherine S. Cho, assistant professor at Loyola University, who I mentioned is actually a perfect guest for this for our second episode, because not only is she a scholar and a researcher, a writer and an academic, but she's also an artist who does improv, she does comedy, and she brings those elements of narrative into her research. So thank you so much for joining us again. Much appreciated. So let me ask a first question, just to put it on, so kind of put it out there right from the gate, okay? In our first episode, we had this whole conversation with our previous guests about, like, the beauty of comedy, and I think the beauty of academia at its best when it's able to name the elephant in the room. Right. And so our previous comic was talking about if he's doing a set and the comic before him trips and falls on the way up, like, he has a moral duty to, like, name that and make a joke about that and just engage that up front. Right. And so right now, in that same spirit, you know, we're sitting here in Evanston, Illinois. We're at Northwestern University, and we've just gone through a crazy few months of campus protests, not unlike the protests across the country. Of course, just this past week, we were, you know, in the news quite a bit because our president was testifying before Congress, and everyone is trying to make sense, right, from all different political perspectives of what's going on. So the first question I want to throw out there for all of us, right, is what do we think about this current moment in higher education in America? What do we think about these college kids protesting at this campus, at Loyola, where you are, and across the country? Like, what are some kind of initial thoughts on that topic?
I guess the first thing I want to mention is that as students are protesting right now, right, there are no colleges in Gaza. There's no colleges in Palestine anymore, right? And I think that sometimes as we put a lot of emphasis on what students are protesting, we forget what they're actually protesting, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important, like, aspect to name, as, like, the centrality of this is as we talk about campus protesting, there are no campuses there. Mm-hmm. And then I think the second thing for this that I spend a lot of time thinking about is, like, who, as we're talking about protests, who is being protected, and how is the language of safety changing, right? As we've been seeing, like, shutdowns, a lot of universities have been saying, well, we got to keep our students safe. But as many of us have seen and observed, right, you go to the protests, you go to, at Loyola, they call them, like, prayer circles, right? Like, a lot of these are nonviolent spaces of learning. There's teach-ins. Like, it's a beautiful space where even, like, basic needs are being met. Food is being shared. Water is being shared. So students are being protected and offered basic necessities that allow for them to live. And so when these places are being shut down in very violent ways, it's like, who is being protected in that space? And it doesn't seem like it's actually the students that are the main priority of what should be kept safe in those moments.
Mm. And this is something we were talking about earlier, but protesting as a student is nothing new.
Yeah.
This is something that we see worldwide, that it's part of free speech and our human right to stand up for the things that we believe in.
Yeah. I'm wondering too, like, what's the onus on the protester, on the student, on the person, on the individual that wants to protest, to make a statement, to draw attention to something, right? Like, what are they willing to sacrifice? Who's asking that question, right? Because you could take it back to the late 60s, early 70s. What was it? Kent State? Mm-hmm. The National Guard came out and, I mean, murdered the protesters on the campus, right? Not saying anybody is wanting to make that sacrifice now. But if you're marching with Martin Luther King once upon a time, you realize walking into it, oh, I might be walking into the last thing that I'm doing to make this statement, right? And like, what are you actually willing to give up? Like, what is the, because what I'm interested in, right, is if right now, if you are protesting the pro palette, whatever your viewpoint is, if you're on a campus, right, and then your phone has 2% battery on it and you go, ugh, all right, let me go ahead and take a timeout from this protesting thing so I can go charge up my iPhone. Mm-hmm. Like, are you, what are you actually doing there? Not saying that that's happening, but not saying that it's not happening, yeah. Right? So, like, is there, you take, I've drawn attention to this before I talk to people. So you take, back in the mid-60s, I think it was Thich Quang Duc, right? He ended up being on the cover of the Rage Against the Machine album. He's a historic monk that lit himself on fire in the middle of, I forget what city they were, right? But he lit himself on fire to protest the conflict in Vietnam, right? What was it, 4 months ago? Bless his heart, I can't remember the kid's name. Mm-hmm. He lit himself on fire.
Aaron Bushnell,
right? Mm-hmm. The news cycle, the first guy, he's memorialized, right? Mm-hmm. And this last guy, the news cycle these days is he was out of there in probably a week and a half. Yeah. Like, is it the same impact? Are these protests having the same impact if right now everybody's paying attention to what rap battles are going on? Are they paying attention to what's happening on college campuses?
I mean, here's what comes to mind for me. I feel like, you made the point that like campus protests are also international, right? And earlier we were talking about how there's a long history, of course, of campus protests here in this country from the civil rights movement, Black Power movement, and so forth, right? Actually, not to do a self-plug, but my first book that's coming out next spring is about university student protesters in Iran. Right, during the 70s, leading up to the 1979 revolution. And part of the story there, part of the finding, and they were actually engineering students. So in Iran, the most radical students are engineering students, right? Mm. And when I say radical, I mean truly radical. I mean, they were learning, you know, they were using firearms, they were in underground cells, they were militant. They were trying to assassinate university leaders, and they eventually literally catalyzed the largest mass movement revolution in the 20th century, right? From the overthrow of the US-backed Shah. So I share that history because your point makes me think about all of that history, international context in relation to the current moment. And I have actually deep, deep admiration and respect for students. And I think everyone should, even if you don't agree with the politics, there's a moral moment where college students who've been, by the way, really demonize and, you know, and say, oh, these kids are all on TikTok, they're not paying attention, they're all addicted to their phones. And yet we see this international moment, this moral moment, and they're stepping up. And again, I'm definitely on the side of the protesters, and I think that even people who aren't necessarily on that side politically, I think there should be a collective ability to say, wow, like, they're really, you know, living up to their morals. But this is my observation. It's really hard, and I'm curious to know what you guys think. They are comparatively to the Iranian context I shared, to the 60s and 70s, they are not violent at all, right? I was walking through the protests in Northwestern. People were doing their homework. People, like, there was children there. It was from my I didn't do like a, you know, full scale study, but just from my observation, just from my own, you know, ears and eyes. I was walked through, and it was a sense of peace, and there was a lot of Jewish students there, probably at Northwestern more so than Arab and Muslim students. And I'm having a hard time understanding how this kind of vibe is being framed nationally as these moments of deep violence. Like, is there, like, do you all agree with that? Or do
can
you
I
see
ask everybody,
different?
Does nonviolent mean non-passionate?
No. You can have full passion without violence. Right.
You're very passionate as a person in a comic, and you're not violent at all.
I've thrown things on stage. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's always a question when you're watching from the outside or when you are protesting and you're in the protest, if the powers above are affected by it at all, or if they're even paying attention, or if they're just like looking down, like when you're in a plane and everyone looks like tiny little ants, if that's what it looks like to them. And they're just like, we need to come in and squash these ants, but they're unsquashable. The voice is resounding worldwide at this point. So, what was the question?
The theme of this episode. what was that?
I'm just trying to. I'm asking this also to you, Dr. Cho, around like, how do we like? Is there a disconnect between, because they have gotten the attention of people in power, right? Like university presidents are losing their jobs, Congress is forming committees, asking questions. People are you know, being like, the thing, there's like 3,000 plus students across the country who've been arrested. So there is an impact for sure that's being had and made. But I just don't, as an observer, not as a scholar of it, I'm not a scholar of the activism, and I'm not deeply connected to it, but I'm watching it, I'm here, right? And I just don't understand the way that it's being talked about nationally around the threats to violence and campus security and what I've seen on the ground, at least in Northwestern, where it seemed extremely peaceful and calm and contained and respectful and civil and all the things that you would, you know, that you would imagine the powers to be would want if they're serious about having freedom of speech, right? But what you're hearing about it in terms of the media is like, look at these pro-terror encampments. And I'm like, really? Like, what is it a fundamental dishonesty at play, or is there something else that I'm not maybe seeing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the cynic in me is like, well, we live in a racial capitalist world, and so this is the byproduct of, like, you know, the media apparatus meeting the industrial complex that we know colleges and universities have to adapt in, because you know, even if you think about the state and federal funding has decreased, right, over like decades, and so now universities and colleges are more susceptible to donor funding and philanthropy and things like that. So there's lots and lots of layers of who they answer to, and so they don't just answer to students. But I think the other part of this that I think a lot about is like, what is the problem and who is the problem? Mm-hmm. Because I think for the students, right, like, and I agree, right, like, genocide is the problem. Like, that's the problem that we're talking about. But I think for universities and for the media and the framing of it, it's students are the problem. Mm-hmm. Students and this protesting is the problem, because if students stop protesting about this, then we will stop talking about the genocide, right? And, like, that's like, how I think then about, like, the aggression of shutting down these protests. I mean, to be clear, right, like, when the civil rights and Black Power movements were happening, like, universities were also very aggressive to Black students, particularly to Black students. And even in 2015, 2016, you think about Silent Sam, the protests in 2018, cops were called at UNC, right? Like, that, like, all of those things have been happening. And yet at the same time, this type of aggression of launching rubber bullets at students, having, you know, hundreds of students get arrested at one night, like, that type of rapidly deactivating their housing keys so that way they're homeless overnight, like, throwing out their belongings in 15 minutes, like, that type of aggression is very much that we're not going to talk about what is the problem, we're talking about who is the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think from the university's perspective, there's no other messaging than students are the problem and we need to get rid of the problem, meaning we need to just get rid of students. Mm-hmm. And like that for me is like where in the past, like when you think about 60s, 70s, 80s movements, it was more like, okay, students are here illuminating a problem and I might not agree with it and let's talk about it. But this type of like aggression is what changes for me of thinking that I feel like fundamentally universities are viewing students as the problem right now. Mm-hmm. And that getting rid of them will get rid of this discourse.
And the quickest way to get rid of the students is by calling them violent and by calling them vandals and by calling them, you know, and I know even what I've heard about protests happening on University of Chicago, instead of, I haven't heard about any of the peaceful organization as much as I've heard, oh, they defaced some 200-year-old door.
Yeah.
And it's like, why are we talking about a door? Do we know about what's happening with the infrastructure in Gaza right now? Like, there are no universities, there are no hospitals.
Yeah.
Left, I think.
I think you're absolutely right about like having like this almost mandate to call them violent, because if they're not framed as violent, then they're protected under freedom of speech, right? This is the ultimate moment where freedom of speech, I feel like, which has interestingly been sort of a right wing call in recent years around like we should have more conservative voices on the college campus, etc. So that same principle right now is being stress tested. It's like freedom of speech. And so students are exercising their freedom of speech, right? And again, from my vantage point, I haven't done the surveys, and there may be some instances I'm not aware of, but from what I've seen, it's been an absolutely civil, peaceful, disciplined, democratic type of expression of speech. And universities have to protect that unless you convince the public that students are now actually violating safety, right? And they're anti-Semitic. And again, not to say that there was not any element of anti-Semitism. Like, I don't want to discount all people's first person narratives. But having said that, I feel like the framing of students has allowed as being violent, as being, you know, endangering the campus community, as obstructing the core mission of the university around teaching and learning, allows them then to say, you know what, yes, we do believe in freedom of speech, but this is an exception. Is that about right?
Well, and like to jump into this, right, like the narrative, right, that Sonal is talking about that I really appreciated of, like, you know, there is a certain narrative that needs to work in order for we need to protect freedom of speech or we need to protect the safety. I think that's the same reason why, like, there isn't a lot of media covering the fact that there's lots of Jewish students who are also fighting for Palestinian freedom and liberation and to end the ceasefire, right? Like, that doesn't fit the narrative then that we need to protect students because the narrative has been we need to protect Jewish students. And I, like, again, don't want to discount anti-Semitism because that is also historically, that's part of the university history. And with that, you know, not including that narrative means that we're losing a lot of the nuance, that this isn't an argument about safety, right? It's an argument about reputation and excising who and what is considered the problem. And I feel like that's been part of the, at least when I see the narrative, right? So then again, like this narrative that students are violent, that students are harming Jewish students, and then we're conveniently leaving out that, you know, there's lots of Jewish student groups that have been part of / helping to lead a lot of these nonviolent teaching and learning moments that are really actually the beacon of what a university setting was supposed to be, yep. Right? That universities are sites of learning, and what is the response to be shutting down sites of learning for what? And the students like, but we were learning here. We were probably learning more here in these moments than we were in our classrooms, but this was the space where we could have had that. And, mm-hmm. and I feel like it's a failure on universities to not be making the most of those teachable moments. Because if a university isn't teaching, then what are we doing? But
there's a safe zone that I think has to be getting out of. Like when I hear terms like violence and the narrative, as you were speaking of, I just replace it with aggression, right? And I don't, how much aggression can be overcome with passiveness? Sure, you can think back on like Buddy that was in the middle of Tiananmen Square with his briefcase facing off with a tank.
Yeah,
but and that's a beautiful moment. But I don't think in like the actual history of it all, he made an impact. He made a tremendous moment, but there was still like how many people massacred in that particular moment, right? Like, you have the historical context of Martin and Malcolm. One of them went in with nonviolence, and the other one went in by any means necessary, and they both had the same outcome. But what is anybody willing to actually, I guess, like, again, my question is, like, what are you willing to put up when you come to do the protests, or when you, if you have an idea of change or drawing attention to, like, are you willing to make the ultimate sacrifice? Are we at that moment? Because right now you're Iranian born, and there's a lot going on. I mean, we could do a whole episode on just what's happening in Iran this week.
Everything's cool in Iran.
Everything. Yeah. I mean, last I heard, they might need some help in the aviation department. Maybe some mechanical engineers.
I would never get on a helicopter.
probably not, you know? But, I mean, a lot of people could call for a revolution anywhere, it feels like. I wonder, like, is this a moment of change? Or is this aggravation, this aggression, these protests, is this where it's happening at? Is this what it feels like when there is a change being made? Do you guys feel that? Because you're in the thick of it.
I feel like it is. I feel like people have put skin in the game. I mean, students have already sacrificed. It might not be, you know, at the level of like what we saw in the 60s and 70s or in other international contexts, but I feel like in this particular moment, like students are taking risks to get out there. And I think Catherine, your point around the fact that I think it's really important to name actually that there was a large number of Jewish students who are at the center of these protests. I shared a story. I'm not sure if I was talking to you about this, but the first time I went onto our campus and I saw the protests, the guy with the bullhorn, he was a Palestinian brother, and he asked, he's like, you know, let me hear it from all the Jewish students. And it was a huge, huge round of applause. And then he said, my Arab and Muslim students, and it was much less, right? So I think it's really important to name that. I think people do have skin in the game. Mm-hmm. I think people are risking a lot, you know? And so I think...
What do you think they're risking it for, though, right? Because if they're risking for things to be fair, I think it's hopeless. Because I don't believe in the word fair. Mm. I believe in the word balance. And balance is, out of 100, 70 and 30 is balance. 80, 20 is balance. I've been in a lot of situations where it's me and another person or my group and another group, and I've never even seen really anybody come close to 51-49. And if they did, it was for a hot second, and then it went back to something that was actually 60-40. It's probably about as close to my relationship. I got my girl. Best of times were 60-40. What's the old, what are they saying, all the things? Happy wife, happy life. You know what that means? 70-30. Her. Hey, these are the drapes we're getting. Give me your card. That's 70-30, but that's also balanced, mm-hmm. right?
So what are you saying about how does that connect to this?
What are we fighting for? Because if we're fighting for fair, if we're fighting for a world that's 50-50, throw it out the window. It's not even a law of nature.
Look, some of the people who I think criticize the students and the media, these are some of the narratives I'm hearing. They're like, people say, these students don't really understand the history of the Middle East, right? My response to that is like, first of all, nobody does. It's an incredibly complex region. So that's one thing. And second of all, what I see, it's not that important to me whether or not a student understands what happened in Palestine in 1948 mm-hmm. or 1967 or what were Yasser Arafat's politics and what's the connection is to Iran or to Hezbollah. Those are nuances that, yes, some people should be getting into the details. But I feel like what I'm feeling is the students want to get connected to something, and they're young, and they want their education to count and to matter. And they're looking and they're seeing, you know, a very deadly war. Right. Mm-hmm. Again, now to get into the history and the how and the why, yes, everyone should further educate. Right. But I feel like they're responding in a very like instinctual way. That's kind of what I'm seeing. And I think that, you know, now what comes of it and what the demands are. And some of them have been very specific, like in Northwestern. They want divestment. Right. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'll share this. Like a lot of people, you know, you brought up Iran. Right. A lot of people from Iran will look around and say, why are students right now in America so passionate about Palestine in particular? Like, why aren't they, like, for example, speaking up against human rights violations in other parts of the world, including Iran? So, for instance, this rapper, Tumaj, like the most famous hip-hop artist in Iran, young guy, brilliant artist, is about to get executed by the state. And it's a very, very dark kind of moment. And so people are sometimes wonder, why have they chosen Palestine as the issue? Mm-hmm. And I don't have a whole sociological answer to that, except for the fact that we know that the United States supports Israel financially. We know that science and technology and the engineering and the innovation that the Israeli military is able to use in this war comes directly out of American universities. Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually, I was like, wow, these students are going, they're talking about what the anti-apartheid folks were talking about. They mm-hmm. want divestment. They want to know where the money of the endowments are going to. I'm like, that's pretty. So that's pretty impressive. I think that's what I've heard in terms of the kind of demands that they're making.
Yeah, and like, I want to jump in for this too, because like one of the narratives of like the students don't know what they're talking about, that this is too complicated. Like I, as a person who studies higher education, I vehemently disagree with these narratives mm-hmm. because like I think that one, students aren't taught how a university functions, and that's actually the stuff that I want to see during orientations,
because
students will graduate not knowing what a provost is. Hell, faculty don't even know what a provost is sometimes, right? Like, if you were like, what does your dean do? I'd be like, well, this is a great question. Right, and so when university administrators or like larger like media narratives are about like, oh, students don't know this, it's like, do students actually not know this, or is this information withheld because that allows for students to remain powerless in actually creating the change that they want, right? Because even as we talk about these narratives of students, you know, creating plans for divestment, even things like if you think about the creation of Black studies, Asian American studies, Latinx studies, like students did the work to figure out how universities function, to think about tenure lines, to think about how departments were created, then created these demands to hold universities accountable. So students aren't like unknowing or like not smart enough or like this system is too complicated. It's like they can figure it out. And I think that that's actually what scares us, because then it's, now we're being held accountable to where our money is going. And like that, I think, is what makes this also really difficult. And to back to your question, Mike, about like what's the cost for this, right? This will cost universities millions of dollars. And at the same time, universities are already losing millions of dollars, right? And I think about that even, for example, you know, for ex-Harvard president Claudine Gay, right, like celebrated such an important milestone for Harvard's history. She was called an anti-Semitic, but in reality, she shut down all of the pro-Palestinian protests. She did exactly what the powers that be asked her to do, to fall in line to make sure she wasn't being anti-Semitic, and then still ended up getting fired, right? And so this idea, like going back to, I think for a lot of protests, like you can't ever beat the master's tool, like, you know, you can't tear down the master's house with the master's tools. Like, but at the same time, students are like, but let's still try. Let's get as close as we can. And I don't think we should fault students for doing that, especially when all of us, and I say that as a person who's in higher education, who gets a paycheck from an institution of higher ed, right? I'm just as culpable in that. And that's like what I think students are really getting at, is that they're getting degrees conferred by institutions that are supporting mass genocide. And that's what they want us to reckon with. And that's what they're, and that's why they're putting themselves on the line, to the point that there are multiple universities that are withholding degrees from the students who are protesting, right? Even as faculty and staff have been like fighting on behalf of students, right? Like signing forms and doing petitions to be like, we need to confer the degrees. And universities are like, this is the cost, that this is your cost. And so I do feel like students are intelligent enough, smart enough, have formed collectives enough to be able to name that, sharpen that, and then try to hold the rest of the institution and like higher education apparatus like accountable to it. And yet the prevailing narrative has been like, oh, students don't know what they're talking about, which like gets me really heated. Like even at the House, the stuff yesterday, the testimonies, they were showing clips of students as if they don't, like they were cherry picking students who didn't know, you know, for the chant from the river to the sea, what river to the what sea. And it's like they're cherry picking students who don't know those answers, and ignoring the narrative that these are huge teaching sessions where students are being very smart and doing all the research to be able to teach and learn about it, because these are complicated issues. And they're like, let's take the moment on the campus to uncomplicate
that. That is interesting you say this. So I've seen that narrative on both sides when they talk about, you know, they'll chant from the river to the sea and they don't even know what it means, and da, 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 da. And of course, I mean, late night comedy television will go out there and pick John Q, what's his name, and be like, well, who was the third president? And I don't know. See, America's dumb. Like, that's just like one of those diversionary tactics. But here's something that kind of frightens me. And I think I was talking to Sapere about it a while ago, right? You remember the bucket challenge, the ice bucket challenge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You remember what it was for?
ALS.
Right? Now, how long was the ice bucket challenge about Lou Gehrig's disease before it was just hashtag ice bucket challenge? I'm going to pour water on myself. I'm not giving any money to anything. I don't know who Lou Gehrig is. How many base hits did he have? Who cares, right? Like, how many? After a while, you give something a brand, and then certain people start it with whatever intentions that they have. What is the road to hell is paved with good intentions? And then how many people are just going to hang on for the hashtag moment, right? Does that make a difference? Because those are going to be the people that get asked, sequestered, spoken to, get interviews, and they're like, I don't know. Everybody else is coming over here, so I'm about to do it. Like, does that make a difference? Does that delegitimize the message if however many people are just there for the moment?
If you're saying some of the students are there because it's fun and trendy, what does that mean for the larger movement?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, I would probably say just off the cuff, that's probably true. That's probably true with everything, right? I can imagine being a college student, and you might not be as political or as engaged, but you see your friends doing it. But that's okay too. Maybe you go the first five times and it's just a social thing, but you're getting educated throughout, and maybe you increase your commitment over time, or maybe you don't. And I'm sure there's examples in both buckets. But yeah, I think it's probably a mixed bag.
I also think it depends on like what type of protest, right? Because like these types of protests are what you consider oppositional activism, right? You're opposing the institution that is technically ensuring like your student status, and you're protesting against them, right? So it's like, you know, so to some degree, like, you know, some people would be like, oh, like, you don't ever want to bite the hand that feeds you. Like, how dare you protest against the university that's conferring your degrees? And so whenever there's oppositional activism, I think that type of like, oh, this is trendy, decreases, because oppositional activism doesn't happen without risk.
That's right.
Right. Mm. And so I even think about like, you know, when students were protesting about BLM, specifically about how universities didn't care about Black lives, cops were being called against students in similar ways, although now even more aggressive ways, in which students are protesting about the divestment. And I feel like in those instances, students also know there's a cost of showing up, because you could be arrested and you could be like, I was just passing down the street and I'm not involved. Mm. And yet you were still there, so you were getting arrested. That I think oppositional activism has that type of risk factor that makes, you know, if you were protesting something else, like we hate Disney, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Disney. Actually, no, I'm anti-Disney. The students are like, oh, I hate Disney. Like, come with us. There's like pizza. And people are like, yeah, like I hate Disney too. Let me stop by. Is different, because that's not oppositional activism against the university or campus. Mm. So I feel like that helps sort of, I think, squash the what I view as like the trendiness of like how activism can turn into like slacktivism, right? Where you're just sort of like, oh, I'm just here for like the trends or the views. Because there's that risk involved.
Because it can be a little distracting. I remember when the George Floyd, like a lot of the protests around George Floyd were at their highest pitch. I remember on the news, I saw they were down in Inglewood, Chicago, and they were showing a group of protesters. And it was the look at our production staff. It was basically them, but just in the heart of Inglewood, Chicago, right? And they were doing their protests, and they ended up interviewing one of the guys from Inglewood, from that neighborhood that they were in, and they gave him a one shot into the camera, and he was like, they need to get out of here. They need to leave right now, because they're here in our neighborhood messing with our police, getting them all pissed off and mad and over nervous, and they're about to leave, go home, have dinner, and then sit right in their dorm room that mom and dad are paying for, and we got to deal with the cops that they just pissed off in the neighborhood we got to live in. And that struck a chord with me, because I was like, man, in their mind, in the student's mind, they were doing something righteous. In the guy's mind that lives in the place that they're trying to do their part to help clean up, he's like, you guys are in and out. I live here. Like, this isn't doing what you think it's doing. And I don't even necessarily know what the if I have a question in the middle of that, but it's like that dichotomy of I'm trying to do something good, but who knows what's going to happen down the line, right?
One aspect of that connects, and this is just based on what I know, right? So within the student movement, you know, I believe there's been some at Northwestern, but beyond, right? So I'm like, you know, the Palestinian students who have family there, or even the Israeli student, Jewish students who have family in Israel, in a sense, both of those groups are more proximal directly to the scene, right, to the conflict. Yeah. And I've heard some accounts of Palestinian student activists having, you know, different sets of ideas around the tactics necessary, and sometimes, you know, maybe less radical or less confrontational than some of the other students, and there's been real hard questions around who's ideas around what direction this student movement goes should we most consider, right? So I think what I'm hearing, and you're like, the people who are most connected to a place and the politics of that place, in my view, you know, their opinions are most pertinent and should be, and should be prioritized. I, you know, in the context of Iran, this is the conversation all the time. It's like Iranians in the diaspora, including myself, we have all kinds of opinions about what should happen in Iran, right? But like many of us have been here 10, 20, 30, 40 years, right? And it's our family in Iran and people in Iran who should be, you know, at the forefront of whatever's happening. Can I segue us into actually a related question that gets us at the kind of convergences and overlaps between comedy and academia? And I think this is actually an interesting case study. So October 7th, we're gonna stay on Palestine because look at the whole episode.
You're smart as hell.
Palestine,
you remember
right?
dates?
Yeah. I mean, October 7th, that one's in my head for sure. October 7th happened, and this is actually another way that I think about the student protests, right? I think part of what the students are telling, I'm looking at the students right now, part of what the students are telling us as faculty is you guys aren't doing a good enough job talking about these issues in your classrooms. You guys are kind of nervous. You guys are kind of awkward. Like, there's this huge thing happening. So if you're not going to do it, then you know what? We're going to take over Deering Meadow and we're going to do it, right? And I feel like that's actually not the way I look at comedy. So it was so October 7th happened. 4 or 5 days later, I happened to find myself in Los Angeles, California. And I love to go to the Comedy Store every time I go to L.A. I have a good friend out there. Shout out Hormoz Rashidi. He's a stand-up comic. He always puts me up at the Comedy Store. He gave me like a table. It was a Friday night. There was all these great comics going. And I went with my friend and we're sitting there and I was coming out of this context, right? Where like everyone was tense. People weren't really talking about the war yet and the, you know, and the attack of Hamas on Israel and the response. Like it wasn't really a conversation happening. And I remember being just kind of shocked at comic after comic going up there, and some of them were taking a pro-Palestinian position, and some of them were taking a more pro, you know, pro-Jewish, pro-Israeli position, and there was sort of a respect amongst the comics for each other, and the audience was like, there was just a willingness to just go there, and I was a little bit shocked, and as I reflect on it, I wonder if that's a crucial difference, and again, I feel like hats off to the comics in the room, because you guys go up there, and if someone is walking up and they trip on the stairs, you're going to comment on it. If there's a war going on that everyone's nervous about, you're going to comment on it. And we're supposed to be doing that at the university. Yeah. And I think some, you know, some do a lot better than others. Obviously, our guest today is one of the people who are at the forefront, you know, having those conversations. But I feel like as a whole, we've lost the capacity in higher ed to really have hard conversations in open ways. And I'm wondering if you guys, as the comics in the conversation, like how does it show up, you know, at 11 p.m. at the Red Room? Like people tend to go there, right? And is there like how do you guys feel about that?
I want to let Sana. Quick thing that I'll say is like we just don't have to worry about tenure or 401ks. Like this is just us. Like if we say something that's bogus, we'll just bomb. And it feels bad.
And in a sense, I mean, you know, we do have to care. And it depends where you are, because we are trying to get tenured into a club or into
mansion.
With a booker or with, you know, and I would fully applaud people like Nimesh Patel, who you were talking about earlier before we were recording the pod, that has...
Nimesh, come on this podcast, man. We want to have you on here.
That he has now... He's
and book me.
At that level where he's, you know, we all strive to be at that level where you can actually... pick and choose who is in your audience and actually, okay, I'm going to remove you from the audience because you are not, you're bringing politics that are not in accordance to liberation of all people and, you know, a humanitarian standpoint. And we definitely have to care about who we're performing to as well. Right. Obviously, it's not the same level that academics have to worry about. And I mean, I applaud anyone because I have friends in the comedy scene, and I know bookers who are like, oh well, he gets a little bit too political, and we want people who are just
Someone in particular?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, gotcha. And I don't want to name
him. Right.
I'll do names after. He's actually one of my favorite comedians, you know, I call him my best friend. That's a big clue for anyone that knows me personally. And I'm always advocating for him, and I'm always so impressed by how, and I myself, you know, I'm a Punjabi American, Indian American. I come from my own history of partition and my own history of colonization. And I don't feel like that narrative is at all what we're talking about right now, but I feel like it's all.
Do you go there in your comedy? Do you engage some of those themes and some concepts around your own history and kind of political history?
If I'm on like an Asian show, or if there's like a Pakistani person in the audience, you know, I'm like, okay, what's up? Partition is over, you know, and I'll make like little comments, or I'm like, oh, get the door, you know, security. And, you know, that's just to put tongue in cheek into situations. And, you know, and do we have the same willingness? I would say it's the same kind of connectedness to the protests that are happening, where going back to the thing that you said, if they're going to target people that are like, this guy doesn't know what the river to the sea is, these students are so impressive because they have access to each other, and they have access to just turn around and go, hey, help me out. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to learn, you know. And there are a lot of comedians who are like, I cannot believe, you know, politics has always been at the heart of comedy. Yeah. And there are a lot of comedians who are like, oh, can we just do, you know, my regular material about how my mother-in-law sucks or whatever, you know. And now it's kind of a very individual journey also of do you want to bring that into your comedy, or do you want to build an audience and then use your social media as a place where you can be real and talk about
politics? You got to dance with who you came with, too. It's and the more you have, the more you have to lose. Like, they have Bassem Youssef, I believe. Yeah. I believe he's Egyptian, comedian. And I want to also say that he's married to a Palestinian woman. And actually, I saw him. He had a joke. I heard him say a joke, like, whenever he's arguing with his, like, his wife, she uses the kids as like human shields. So once you walk in the door with that joke, they can't pull you back. Once you open up with that, if you reach any levels of success, I'm bulletproof when it comes to that stuff. But if you are a Kevin Hart, if you're any late night Conan, Kimmel, whatever, go ahead, get up on stage and say something goofy like that. But you're going to get taken out of your spot, because that's not who brought you to the party. But if you're Bill Maher, and that's your whole platform is talking politics, you're going to have a whole lot of leeway, I think. But, I mean, once you start getting a decent amount of money and supporters and whatnot.
There are a lot of comedians being very careful about the powers that be. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm.
So what's the politics of the comedy world? Because I definitely didn't have that impression at all. I feel like there was just a... So what are the sort of politics of comedy around like issues that are sort of off limits or... points of view? Is it the same ones that we've kind of named in relation?
Did they laugh? That's the politics of comedy.
Oh, but that's different. If that's what it is, that's what I originally thought. Are you guys also saying that in addition to that, right, which is the pure sort of artistic piece of it, are there people who sort of control the strings of comedy clubs?
Yeah.
Where it's going to shape the kind of humor and the kind of content that you guys are willing to put out there?
The most hilarious comic, Joe Blow, funniest dude that would kill this entire room, is not necessarily going to be the one that makes it to the upper echelons of the comedy world or get the biggest bags of money, because maybe he's a recluse, maybe he's a bit shifty, maybe he's socially awkward, he doesn't have his own things to exchange for power. Nobody wants to rock with him. Like, he's not friendly to the booker, the promoter. He calls everybody jerks or whatever. And he's going to be the most hilarious open micer that works at Denny's for the rest of his life. And there's going to be somebody that's just peanut butter jelly. Ha, ha, ha. You didn't teach me anything. I didn't learn anything that wasn't hilarious. And you're everywhere you go, you're going to see him. It's the most popular comedians are like, ugh. I mean, we see people, we're in the world, like it's a crazy pick. One day you're standing next to a guy, we were just, you know, in a beat down Jeep Cherokee going to a gig together, and then it's like, wait, you're famous now?
How did that happen? Kind of do okay, you know, and then you see him rubbing shoulders with people that you're like, okay, well, what set did y'all see?
Wait. If I would have known fame was coming last week, I would have wore my good clothes.
In terms of the invisible hands, I mean, they're called invisible for a reason.
Yeah.
Because we can't see them. We
so,
don't know.
So basically, you know, Jerry Seinfeld's recent comment that like wokeness is killing comedy is just complete bullshit. Right? I mean, I feel like is that, because I feel like you guys are saying the opposite of that in a sense.
Nah. Well, any hyper awareness, jokes are jokes.
And if you have built your career on a platform of, you know, privilege and entitlement, you know, and then you're like, why isn't anyone responding well to my Pop-Tart movie? You know, yeah. And it's like, I mean, read the room, dude. Like, I'm definitely somebody that can't necessarily separate the art from the artist. And
yeah, that's hard.
That's a very new phenomenon that we're experiencing, right? Because we just didn't know, you know, like Bill Cosby didn't know the internet was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's someone who's been championed for so long, you know, and it's not like he was doing any, and that was just kind
happening of happening in a ditty right now as we speak.
Oh my gosh, you know, and it's like there are power, you know, they say that Weinstein was just, he was one element that was removed so that the horrible machine can just stay in place, you know, and it's those kinds of things where we don't really know what's happening, and that's why trends are, and so wokeness is killing people like Bill Cosby and Jerry Seinfeld, you know, but then if you are a woke comedian building a platform, like Nimesh, I would consider very woke, and I don't think he would consider himself necessarily so woke, but he's very passionate and very clear in his voice.
Completely agree.
But then also jokes are jokes. Like if you're woke to the point where you get mad at Bernie Mac because he said, I believe when a kid turns 6, you have the right to punch him in the throat or the stomach if they get out of line. If you stand on a soapbox for that, it's like, these are jokes. Now, if you say that in the context of I'm a professor at Loyola, good luck to you. You might not make it to that tenure.
Well, and I feel like part of this is that, like, even with like the comment of like wokeness is out of control or things like that, I'm like, for comedy and even for academia, like this is the reckoning that we have too, is like you have to be able to read the room. And I think the room is shifting. And like, you know, this is like one of the things that I like to talk about with my friends of like, is this generation different than the generation before? And I'm like, fundamentally, yeah, because I think that like I remember at the previous place I worked at before I came to Loyola, people all the time would say like, I have faith in the institution. And I would be like, what? I have anti-faith. Like, I have no faith in an institution. I'm not going to trust the institution for nothing because I don't assume that the institution is a family. I don't assume that the institution has my back. Like, it is there to make money because that is what an institution is. And I think that's what this generation is. And so it's the room is shifting. And so to that very point of like folks complaining that like, oh, wokeness is out to get me. I'm like, I don't think you know how to read the room anymore to realize that those are not the jokes that land. And I think similarly, when I think about colleagues who are academics who will be like, well, I just want to teach on the thing that I want to teach, and I don't want to, why does my research on biology have to comment on, you know, liberation? It's like, well, but the students you have right now are different students than the students in the 1980s, because also our society and our relationship to how much we trust institutions and the fact that the healthcare system in the 80s and the healthcare system now is way different, that like, of course you should be adapting and changing. And so like, those are things that I also think about of like, where, like, I feel like comedians are trained to read a room or maybe not, I don't know. But I can confidently say academics are not trained to read the room. And I think that's the reason why some of us are struggling and folks are like, I don't know how to talk about contemporary issues. And it's like, but we have to, because this is what is demanded on us, because that's our job.
Comedians can definitely be parallel to that, where if you have been developing your material and, you know, a club crowd is very different than a Logan Square crowd, which would be considered a very woke neighborhood, you know, and it's very interesting to see then as a working comedian what, and you have to listen to where the laughs are. It's very easy to blame the room and say, oh man, my jokes are just really not hitting in this room, instead of, okay, my jokes are hitting differently in this room and I have to pay attention and I have to kind of curate myself to, because I know Kevin Hart said something like a joke should work in front of any audience, which I don't agree with at all. Because there are jokes. I mean, if I'm doing a joke in Hindi, I don't expect people that don't speak the language to know what I'm saying.
Do you do jokes in Hindi?
I have some jokes in Hindi.
Oh, that's amazing.
They're okay. They're
that's cool.
I got the half Indian kid looking at me like, let's hear it.
I can't speak for you, but sometimes I cheat. Like if I'm doing a local Chicago show, like I have jokes about the train or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The red line.
Of course. Yeah. But if I go to Dubuque, Iowa, and I go, you ever been on the green line? And the... No, I haven't. That makes no sense.
So you have, and if you have the kind of, you know, and it's so funny to even be anti-woke because what are we talking about? We're talking about people who are asking questions and want to be more informed about their experience, you know. And I mean, somebody like Bill Cosby, he prefers them to be asleep completely, you know, just.
What a joke. Snuck one in there past the goal.
That was a zinger. Did we catch that?
That was very well done.
Damn.
Which is, thank God that we're able to laugh about this stuff. You know, because it's like this, these are the things that we're, I mean, we literally are in Facebook groups where it's like, careful, there's somebody out roofing at, what's the name of that, Mike?
It was actually not called
On Blast, actually. Yeah. But, you know, and that's just in the culture where it's like, okay, if you're a woman and you're going out, please buddy up, you know, and please make sure that you have eyes on your drink at all times.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just something that you have to be aware of, you know, and it's a pretty toxic culture, comedy, until it's not, until you get to the point where you have people around you that you trust and you're working with. And
so I'm a little bit confused. Are we saying, so let's start with academia for a minute, right? Because there's these same conversations and debates happen in academia where some of our colleagues will say the function of higher learning, the function of research in the academy is not political because knowledge is not political. Right? Because truth is not political, because it's about science, it's about evidence, and we're not here to be activists, we're not here to follow an agenda. We are here to collect data, to do analysis, and to write up the results objectively, and it should be neutral, and that's the function. And anyone who's doing different than that, anyone who's troubling the waters, as our previous comic or scholar Dave Stovall was talking about, is actually muddying the waters, right? And it's not doing the job well. It's actually politicizing academia, right? And then there's those of us, well, I think we're on the same page about this.
My eye rolls earlier.
Cue all the eye rolls, which is like, no, knowledge is never apolitical. It's never neutral. It's always connected to context and social conditions and politics. I'm really curious how that set of debates plays out in the world of comedy. Is there a similar kind of debate where people say, look, comedy is about art. It's not about politics on the one hand. And on the other hand, people are like, no, like comedians have a responsibility to shift the narrative, to educate society, to make them laugh in hard times. Like, how do you guys think about that?
When I go to McDonald's, they have a responsibility to give me a burger and fries. When you come to a comedy show, I have a responsibility to make you laugh. And you're going to tell me instantaneously if I'm doing a good job or not.
Okay.
Like, that's where it stops. Everything that comes after that, you can take on, yes, and I'm not speaking for anybody, you could take on more responsibilities after that. Okay, now I have a platform, now I have influence, people are listening to me. I'm going to go on Shannon Sharpe's show and call out the bogus Hollywood industry and the puppet masters and whatever's going on in the background behind the curtains. You can do that, but comedy, period, if you or either one of you guys get a babysitter, spend some money, get a 2-drink minimum, come out, you're coming there to laugh, period. If I get a scholarship or tuition or something like that to twist it to your guys' world, and I'm coming to get education, a way of looking at things fundamentally, how to, you know, critical processing and thinking and stuff like that, and a piece of paper I can hang over the wall so that I can make 6 figures minimum a year. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But you come to a comedy show.
But I think
you agree with that?
I would agree with that, and I would also add to that that we live in a very blessed time where we have access to things like microphones and the internet, and you can build a platform, and we live in such an abundance of comedians that you can have a night out where you just want to laugh and be surprised, and then you can have a night where you want to experience somebody like Sammy Obade, you know, who is a highly political, highly on the spectrum, he's a mathematician. He has multiple degrees.
We talked about him, right?
Yes.
He does math and Middle East comedy.
And if you are somebody, just an average audience member, and so he has amazing clips about this too, where he talks about Palestine and he talks about Israel, and he'll kind of lead you on a very long journey to release the tension with some ridiculous dad joke or brilliant pun that's almost frustrating because it seems so dumb. It's kind of like a magic trick, you know, where you're like, if a magic trick is revealed, you're like, that's it? That's all you're doing? Come on, you know, but you still have to train the sleight of hand and you still have to train to get to that point. And if you're a regular audience member just going for your two drink minimum, you might be like, how dare you?
So that's my question.
Think and consider politics when I just came out to laugh and hear some quality dick jokes.
Yeah,
right. And that's okay. Fair enough. But so for Sammy in particular, and comics like him who are explicitly political, right? Does the audience have to agree with the comic in order to get the joke?
No.
Does he? I'll take a groan. I'll take a.
Well, and also it's kind of interesting to see how he has clips like this where you have people who are like, "Shut up, stop," and then you see that he gets them eventually.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
and they start.
We need
laughing.
To learn how to do that. Yeah. That's what we don't do that well. We're not able to. In higher ed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my impression of it. We don't have the ability to say, I completely disagree with the politics that's kind of implied in your research or your teaching, but I respect it. That doesn't happen as often.
I think there's more of a
tribal.
I just want to say the power of laughter, I don't think is something
it's a different muscle
in academia.
Right.
It's a different muscle. And to what Catherine was saying earlier about reading the room, if I do have somebody that's a heckler or just being that person in the audience, if I've already won the room, if they're with me, they'll do most of the work for me. And whenever I have to address that person who's ruining our good time, right, guys? They're all with me. If I don't have the room and that's the town crier for the crowd that isn't feeling me,
you're in trouble.
Good luck. Yeah. Good luck to you. And I don't know how that would translate in academia because, I am providing a very direct service. And I'm commanding an emotion in you. Like, you're not just going to spontaneously. Sometimes I spontaneously laugh for no reason. But that's crazy.
Let's ask Catherine, because you were a professor in Florida.
Oh, no, in Ohio.
In Ohio. Yeah. Okay, so how...
It feels like Florida.
Yeah.
And very different from being a professor in Chicago. So how did your style or your way of engaging, your presence, the feeling that you had, the vibe that you had as an educator change across... cross context.
Yeah, yeah. So before I answer that, I'm gonna like do the thing that faculty do, which I'm gonna say is I'm gonna talk about something else first.
answer the question you wish I had asked you.
Yes. I'm gonna answer my own question and then I'll answer your question. Because one thing that I also do think is important to name is that like there's a power dynamic that's different in the classroom than in a comedy room, in the sense that I'm assuming that like if, for example, an audience member really hates your set, they can leave and there's no consequence other than that they had bought a ticket.
Mm. Right.
But a student cannot leave my classroom if that class was
that's
required,
interesting,
because they know I could fail them. And I feel like that's also a dynamic where, because of that, do I want to talk about Palestine in my classroom all the time? Yeah, absolutely. Do I? To a certain degree, but to another degree, I have to moderate it in the sense that I can't create a culture of fear where I have a student who can't approach me to ask questions because now they're scared of what I think about them and how I'm going to grade them.
I never thought about that. We're contemporaries. You're an authority figure.
Yeah, and I feel like that's something that sort of gets, and that's why also, like, you know, the joke is I'll always tell my student, I'm not your friend. And I need them to know that I'm not their friend, not just because I don't want to be their friend, but also because like if they think I'm their friend, then they might say things to me that are going to fundamentally change how I view them as a student or change my letter of recommendation to them. Right. And so like it's actually my responsibility to help them remember what the line is, because like, oh, we can talk about a bunch of stuff and I want to be mindful and careful and view them as a whole human. But I also know at the end of the day, I have to input grades for them. And like that type of power, and to not acknowledge that power, I think, is irresponsible as a faculty member that makes me then think about the classroom differently of how am I cultivating fear in the classroom and how do I minimize that, even if I talk about, so even for example, as I've been talking about Palestine in the classroom, I've been taking it as a very historical lens of this is an example of how much we don't know in education. Like, this is a fundamental aspect of the failures of educational institutions, of how we're not talking about these issues. Here are resources for you to learn if you want to talk to me one-on-one about this. Like, and I'll do that. And basically, students know me well enough to know that I'm pretty pro-Palestine. But I also know that if students are not pro-Palestine or are unsure or want to ask me questions, that they feel like I'm not going to fail them in my class. That I feel like is a nuance that, for example, so now going back to your question of how did this feel in Ohio, I feel like my contemporaries in Loyola, we understand the culture of fear. And I appreciate that. I'm also in a department and a program that is, I'm in a program that is all people of color, and in a department that I think talks about whiteness and the nuance and power dynamics of how whiteness moves in the classroom, of like authority figures changing that, stressing that, naming that, and then thinking about how do we not create cultures of fear. In Ohio, in Southwest Ohio, where I was at Miami University, which gets super confusing then because then people think it's Florida, and it functions a lot like Florida because it's highly, you know, there's Proud Boy stickers everywhere. I had a 55-minute commute. 45 of the 55 minutes was all Trump 2024 signs, right? And so because of that, you had faculty who would sort of be like, my way or you're failing. So I had students who were not conservative pretend to be conservative. Wow. Because they had to show up for their class because they were scared to do that. And if I tried to explain that to, or like challenge other faculty members too, they would also be like, oh, you're not going to get tenure here. I'll actively work to not get you tenure here. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the type of like the power dynamics that sometimes we also like, oh, now I forgot what the question was. Sorry. But you know, that I feel like sometimes as we talk about, I like to say that the classroom is the stage, but in reality, there's a slightly different power dynamic where students don't have the ability or the privilege to leave the way that they might be able to in like other spaces where they're, oh, I forgot, Mike, what you said. It was such a good term for like authority versus like
contemporaries.
Contemporaries.
Yeah.
Yeah. That like, I think about in my role that I also think in Ohio, like where I was in the red state, and it was a much more conservative environment of viewing it as like, we don't need to worry about students being scared because they need to just learn and they need to learn our way or the highway. And it was like, but fear doesn't allow for learning. So how do we decrease fear to actually have those dialogues? And to that credit, there were also faculty members there at Miami who did really strong work to try to like change the environment. Mm. But I ultimately had to leave because I felt like I was dying trying to fight. It felt like I was fighting too many systems. And so I needed more people who understood that, because I couldn't fight the system and fight white supremacy and fight racism and being the only Asian American woman in a college of education, health and society, which is like over 100 faculty. And when the murders of the eight people, six of whom who were Asian American women in Atlanta happened that same day, they were like, you need to make the statements, you need to hold the healing circles. And I'm like, I'm grieving and checking in with my friends who are in Atlanta to see if any of our community members are affected, and like not seeing any of that and trying to fight against all of those layers, it just was too exhausting. So I also feel like there's, at least here, one of the differences that I have a better capacity with like-minded people to better strategize, because you can't be an activist as an island, right? And so like you need contemporaries, you need community that was in Ohio but also was so much smaller that I think made it so that you couldn't make the institutional changes you needed. And I think I feel like that, and I feel similarly for like, to go back to like the students protesting for Palestine, like the students who are outnumbered know that they're outnumbered, and they might be like a handful of students in super conservative areas or maybe even non-conservative areas who can't protest. Like they can't even get to the space of doing an encampment because they don't have the numbers. And so like, I think about that too, of like the geographic privileges of where have we been able to do protests, or even like my geographic privilege now as a faculty member at a private university in a largely blue city and blue state versus like the confines that I had of how much activism I could do and how limited I was, even for like my own health, but also on behalf and with my students, knowing that we were like a very purple dot in a very red state, and mm-hmm. in a state that's even getting more red as we continue.
So it's... Is this, because I think you're absolutely right, it would be completely frustrating to have to fight through all those layers. But I also wonder, too, like, who's dictating? It feels like there's an implied good and bad, or good and evil, or right and wrong, right? Or is it all perspectives, right? Because I think one of the, I talk about it on stage, anybody that hear it, like, I think one of the most destructive things happening in this country right now is white guilt. Like, just anybody walking around feeling guilty or acting out of guilt. And you, I think you just touched on it as well. I forget exactly what you said, but you were basically saying like, it's hard to listen if you're, I forget, what was the question again? But no, awareness, I'll take awareness over guilt. Mm, yeah. Like,
what about light skin guilt?
That's what I'm saying. But no, but I mean, to laugh, once upon a time, there was the reason why it's called light skin. There used to be the brown paper bag test, right? Mm-hmm. Light skinned is not, the word mulatto is not an endearing term. Being light skinned, so once you take away all the, disappear all the white people from this planet, there's still plenty of racism in the black community amongst ourselves. We don't need white people to be racist. Right now, they're talking about the Kendrick and Drake thing. It's nothing but light skin jokes. Go back to that movie. I had Ice-T and Nino Brown, and God, I forget the name of it right now. Huh? New Jack City. Yeah. Thank you. One of the coldest lines out of Nino Brown. He stabbed Albie Shore out of the hand. I hate your. I never liked this pretty motherfucker. Like, the light skin thing is very real. You know what I mean?
And it's a global.
Yeah. It's phenomenon. A global thing. In India, they have light skin, dark skin. Yeah.
Top fast moving consumer goods.
Asian community, I'm assuming.
Skin bleaching, totally.
Oh,
a thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Sammy like Sosa, forget about it. Like, it's an ingrained thing. So I'll take awareness. Like, I am aware that I'm a man, but I don't walk around with the guilt of being a man in a world that's designed and tilted in the axis of power largely to men. We sit down and we have this conversation. If you bring up, and I ask, and I would love to find out, you know, trials, tribulations, and the gatekeepers when it comes to being a professor, a woman professor in the world today. Like, I asked Sono, I asked female comics, like, what's it like being a female comic operating in how many stories are we hearing right now of tenured comics that are gatekeepers that make it hard to be a woman in that profession? So I'm aware that I'm a man, that on its surface, on paper, it's an easier world for a man. I don't feel guilty about it, because me feeling guilty about it, I don't see it as accomplishing a lot. But if you bring me more awareness of like what's bogus about it, like, I'm aware I'm right-handed, and it sucks if you're left-handed. You know what I mean?
I think one of the things I really like about this conversation is also like nuancing what's the difference of like, is it people are the villains or are structures villains?
Yeah.
And I generally think structures are the villains, but so even for example, like when I talk about white supremacy, I'm not anti-white people, but I'm anti-whiteness.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is like the ways that whiteness gets normative, so that, for example, we say things like, oh, you know, when it's like winter time, we say like, oh, have a great Christmas. And we're not talking about, and we assume that everyone celebrates Christmas, right? Mm. And that's not necessarily like to whiteness, but like examples like that, or even, you know, assuming that everybody, let's say, does the, oh my gosh, like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, or like there's like markers of culturalness that's tied to, I think, American whiteness that can be really harmful, but that's not an anti-white person thing, right? And I feel like that helps for me nuance and explain to folks that, like, much in the same ways, critical race theory is not about, like, oh, we need white people to feel guilty or whatnot. It's understanding that race and racism has been so deeply embedded that we don't talk about things like redlining that then have shaped all of our geographic neighborhoods, right? Or like our suburbs, and why are the zonings the way that they are, or like school budgets or things like that. Mm. And I think that also then helps name that how, for example, East Asian Americans who have largely been the poster child for anti-affirmative mm-hmm. action, how, which I am pro-affirmative action, right? But how East Asians in particular fold into whiteness because they, even though they're not white, they still believe in the markers of what we understand as white supremacy mm. because they believe that affirmative action is stealing their spots when that's not what that conversation is about. And so
I think we were talking about a little bit before we came on camera. My question is, who is assigning white? It's not a culture. It's not. It's a construct from God knows when. You're of Asian descent, but bless my heart if I was to get you confused with anything. That's why I asked you blanketly, like, what's your heritage? It just so happens that white and black are the only cultures in America specifically that choose that. But I'm not Haitian. I'm not African. I'm not Jamaican. I'm black, which in the context of America means African-American descent, right? And in the context of white, I don't even really know what that means, because back in the 40s, there was Irish people because of the potato famine. There was German people because World War II was over. There was the Polish people because of all this, World War II again. And when they came over here, everybody was individuals. Everybody was, ew, these mixed, these dirty Irish people are coming over, taking all the jobs. Ew, these Italians are coming over here, causing all this problems and da 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 da. And then once upon a time, who knows when, who knows how, it just became white. But who assigned that?
The census in large part does this. I wouldn't be a faculty member if I didn't recommend a book. So White by Law by Ian Haney Lopez
nice.
Is a book about the historical construction of whiteness. Because actually in the 1800s, essentially whiteness is a construction that is viewed as non-blackness. So Asian Americans, even dark-skinned South Asian Americans who came to the U.S. in like the 1880s, they were classified as white until they started getting really wealthy. And then it was like, we need to find a new category that's not black, but it's also, it can't be white. And so that's how, in many ways, the Asian category like started to get constructed. So like, I've appreciated that, because then when folks are like, to go back to Sapere, your question about like, well, data is data. It's like, but people make categories of data. That's why data is political. Because then when folks are like, well, the census data is just data. And I'm like, yeah, but people assigned categories.
And there's resources attached to those categories.
Right.
So then,
like, Middle Eastern folks have to classify themselves. They have to check the white box because that's what it's viewed as. And the census has still yet to change that, despite all of the research and work and sort of arguments that like, this actually needs to be accounted as a separate category. But the census largely drives a lot of that. So even, like, Latinx and Hispanics weren't constructed until like the 2000s, maybe late 1990s was the first time that was constructed, and now they got to count. And now that once you count, then you can be involved in like the policies or whatnot.
Well, it feels like that's the biggest game, because once you name something, make something, create a team, you've automatically, by law of nature, created its opposition. So once you say white, in a lot of people's heads, you're thinking it's some conference room with all the white guys that look like him and like long things with cigarettes at the bottom going, how do we continue to take over the world? See? And it's like form follows function. Like, your skin looks like mine. Your skin looks like mine. Okay. Give me a discount at your business. I'll give you a discount at mine. What are you, Irish? What are you, whatever, Russian? Okay. Well, who cares? Let's just be white. And I think right now I hate the census, because if they're the ones that did it, then they're the ones pulling all the puppet strings. And I don't, it seems like we're just getting the buckets of water out the boat instead of actually plugging the hole. And we're just going to keep chasing each other's tail, playing this on the surface level game of white and black when it's definitely not that simple, I don't think. And it goes back, in my mind, it goes back to the ice bucket challenge. Like, what is it actually about, like, when you dig past it, you know?
It's definitely not that simple. And I think that's probably a good place we can leave it. This has been the second episode of, what's it called again?
A professor and a comedian walk into a bar.
Thank you very much, all our listeners out there. Thank you to our wonderful guest today. We appreciate your time.
Professor Catherine Cho and the very...
Catherine S. Cho.
Wow. I feel that too. Because Michael Knight, my name, that used to be the name of Knight Rider. So from now on, I'm Michael A. Knight. There we go. And
Sonal Agarwal.
Yeah, I'm going to keep messing it up. But I love you. I love you with all my heart. Absolutely. Dope. And I'm Mike Knight. And then, yeah.
Yep. And I've been Sapir Vakil, your co-host. Thank you very much for tuning in. Please check out our next episode. Dropping soon. Thank you.
Subscribe.